You might remember that the last in this series on the seven deadly sins was on lust, which I called faking love. And you might remember that I said that there were two reasons for desire being out of disorder. And now I think I want to say that there are three reasons. Going down in the train to Weston-super-Mare last Saturday for the convention, I was reading the biography of a new book about Byron, and particularly about his sexual experiences, and I think in one sense he was quite unique sexually. And the man at the end of the review was trying to sum up why all this happened to Byron. And he made quite a remarkable comment to me, for me at least, was that Byron basically was in love with himself. And I think that that may be a third reason why desires are out of order. Well, we're turning to the most difficult of the seven deadly sins today, gluttony. And you'll see that it's called in your notes, cooking your own goose. And I've called it that name because there's a famous Anglican parson called Ogden, who was a lecturer at Cambridge. And he was once asked what he thought about a goose as something that you could eat. And he said that he always found it a very tiresome bird. It was never quite enough for one, and it was too much for one, and never quite enough for two people. And he was a notorious overeater, so much so that even if you go to Cambridge till this day, you'll hear a poem about Ogden that goes something like this: by Isis or Cam's ancient seat, there lived a priest endued with boorish pride who could eat almost till he spewed. If you're eating sandwiches at the moment, I'm terribly sorry about that. Anyway, gluttony, and as I say, it's the most difficult subject for me to deal with. I think it is the most difficult of the seven deadly sins. In the notes, you'll see that I make a reference to Deuteronomy 32 and verse 15. Deuteronomy 32 is a favorite chapter of mine. It's the song that Moses sings when the people of Israel have come through the wilderness. We've looked before, I think it is, at verse 11, where he says, as the eagle stirs up its nest. And that's something that happens to eagles to this very day, high up in their nest. The parent bird stirs up the nest, causing the baby eagle to stand on the very edge so it falls out, so it learns to fly. And then later on in Deuteronomy 32, verse 15, Moses says these words that are almost unintelligible, but Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. The name Jeshurun comes four times in the Old Testament, once in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 15, twice in the next chapter, 33 verses 5 and 26, once in Isaiah 44 and verse 2. Strictly speaking, it is not a name, it's a term of endearment, and it means the upright one, the beloved one, the darling one. And it's a term of endearment that is used to express the most precious relationship. And for the four times that it's used in the Bible in the Old Testament, it's not used of a particular person, but of a particular nation. The upright one, the beloved one, the darling one of God, is the nation of Israel, God's people. So Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. The picture there is of a pampered animal, fatted and cared for like a family pet, which does not return this affection but becomes treacherous and dangerous. Instead of becoming tame and gentle, it responds to kind treatment by becoming vicious and ugly. But if you've got those notes in front of you, you'll see that the first heading is luxurious living can easily lead away from God. I've got another verse in there, Psalm 106 and verse 15. God gave them all that they desired, but brought leanness to their souls. I'm always skeptical when people say they've prayed about something, and God has given it to them, and they say, well, therefore it must be right. That's not necessarily so. As you see David writing here, God gave David a variety of things, and they weren't necessarily right for him. God gave them all they desired, but he brought leanness to their souls. I don't often disagree with Paul Tournier, but I disagree with the statement that he makes about gluttony. He says that there are only four kinds of gluttony. There is gluttony for praise, which is vanity, gluttony for power, which is tyranny, gluttony for sexual experience, which is lust, gluttony for money, which is avarice. Maybe just the way that my mind works, but I think he's missed out one very important form of gluttony. I want to add to that list that there is a gluttony for punishment, which is called masochism, but that may be just the way that my mind works, as I say. But when the word gluttony is used in the Bible, it is used specifically of excessive indulgence in food and drink. So let's notice one or two things. First of all, that Christianity does not despise the healthy pleasure of eating and drinking. Jesus was not an ascetic. An example would be the story in John 2, at that tiny wedding reception where he turned 180 gallons of water into 180 gallons of wine. I've heard people try to explain away that story by saying that it wasn't fermented wine or wasn't the sort of wine that we know today, but that doesn't, in my mind, get around the story, because elsewhere in a place like Proverbs we read that wine maketh merry and feasting is for laughter. There is a legitimate pleasure in eating and drinking. In the gospel narrative we often find Jesus as the guest of someone's table, for instance with Simon in Matthew 26 and verse 6. He was willing to eat at the table of a despised tax collector, Luke 5 and 29. I think that this is a very important point here, because being away in the West Country last week at that convention, twice I had people coming to me with problems about Taylorites. And I actually met a man who had, a woman who had not slept under the same roof as her husband for 30 years. She'd prepared meals for him and had not sat at the same table with him because he was an exclusive and he wanted to keep his table pure to himself. Now, I think that that is a disastrous position and has nothing to do with biblical Christianity. Christianity does not despise the healthy pleasure of eating and drinking. Dr. Johnson shrewdly remarked, "A man is generally better pleased when he has a good dinner upon his table than when his wife can talk Greek." Amen to that. And a man who does not mind his belly, said Dr. Johnson, hardly ever minds anything else. And that's very true. Very true. Do you know how you sometimes meet that sort of person that they're not really concerned about food? They have no enjoyment for food. It's often a reflection of their whole personality. They don't enjoy social intercourse at all. They're not really concerned with the things of life. So, Christianity does not despise the healthy pleasure of eating and drinking. And then notice that Christianity is not distinctively ascetic. The monks and hermits who deliberately starve themselves over a long lifetime were not in the mainstream of Christianity. Perhaps I might amend that and say not in the mainstream of biblical Christianity. Christianity has nothing against a man who enjoys God's gift of eating and drinking. Now I think I'm going to say something that I've never said before or never expressed before, and that is this, that one of the distinctive features of biblical Christianity is its materialism. I think that's very important that we should say that today. There are many distinctive features of Christianity, but this is one of them. At our student meeting on Sunday, a Pakistani came up to me afterwards, and because I had been knocking the obedience of law as a way of finding God. And he said, "Well, surely if we obey godly principles, we can find God." And I said, "Well, that's not true. That's never true. The schoolmaster is never a law to bring us to God." That in Exodus, the redeemed people live out the law, have the law given to them as an expression of their redeemed life. You can't do it the other way, by going through the law to become redeemed. The typical sort of sermon that you hear every week in a typical Anglican church is, you know, plod with God and you will be all right. Plod with God, try and obey his laws and you will be redeemed. I'm using Tony Neve's phrase down here, so I must say that that is his phrase. And that is not true. Christianity is exactly the other way around. You are redeemed, therefore you want to obey the laws. And he said, the Pakistani, that surely all religions are a movement from man towards God. And I said, well, of course, that's quite true. All religions are a movement, basically, from man Godwards, except Christianity, which is coming in the other direction. It's a movement from God towards man. There's a distinctive feature of Christianity. A second distinctive feature would be its sheer materialism. You see that in the Old Testament, that righteous people were blessed with earthly blessing, and that's still true today. I think the more righteous you are, the more you stand the chance of gaining in earthly possessions. And look at this point about materialism. The great religions of the world are anti-materialistic. They have no concern for the world, and they have no concern for the body. I suppose in one sense that springs from the Greek religion, who said that the world was corrupt, and that the body was the prison house of the soul, and that all that mattered was the soul in a man. Well, when we were looking at Psalm 23, we spent some time looking at that phrase, he has redeemed or restored my soul. In Hebrew, the word soul is a synonym for me. He has restored, he has redeemed me, the whole me, every bit of me, my mind, my body, my spirit, my soul, all of me. But the Greeks would say, what happens to the body is of little importance, because what is important is the spirit within a man. If he overeats, that doesn't matter. If he fornicates, that doesn't really matter, because it's only happening to the body. But the distinctive feature of Christianity, or one distinctive feature, is its materialism. We are concerned about the world. While I was traveling down to Weston-super-Mare, I was reading a book called Out of My Mind, by Joseph Bailey, an American writer. You might have read his book because his three children have died, and he's written a very good book on death. And Out of My Mind is a selection of the editorials that he has written for the American IVF magazine, his. And the first editorial is called Thank God for Ice Cream. And it's about an elderly lady who, in the south of America, goes to a big convention, and it's so hot that when she comes outside, someone buys her an ice cream, and she has a lick of it and hands it away. And she says, it's so nice, it can't be godly. So she gives it away. And the whole force of the editorial is that every good and perfect gift cometh from above. Thank God, says Joseph Bailey, for ice cream. Thank God for music. Thank God for tennis. Thank God for every good and perfect gift. Thank God for the material world. Christianity, one of its things by which we recognize it is its materialism. I stutter because I've lost my place in my notes. Luxurious living can easily lead us away from God. Jeshurun waxed fat and he kicked. Psalm 106, God gave them all that they desired and brought leanness to their souls. Well, how can we see what is not a legitimate pleasure and which is gluttony? How can we find the dividing line between these things? Well, first of all, I think clearly that excess is wrong. We eat to live, not live to eat. I think one of the rules is that pleasure producing health is a legitimate enjoyment, and pleasure that damages health is not a legitimate enjoyment. That's certainly true so far as gluttony is concerned. Obviously, extravagance is wrong. People frequently spend on one meal more than some people spend on the meals for a whole week or a whole month. In my notes, I've underlined the word frequently, because of course we're going to spend sometimes extravagantly on one meal, just for our own enjoyment and for the enjoyment of other people, and that's clearly going to be right. We're going to entertain. That's a very vital part of the Christian life today, entertaining our friends so that we may speak to them about godly things or encourage them in the godly life. Extravagance is wrong. The sort of extravagance that I have in mind is the sort of Roman extravagance where they made pies out of nightingales' tongues and peacocks' brains. And the sort of extravagance that I have in mind is the man that finds a whole goose is just a little bit too much for him and is never enough for his wife and himself to share. A third thing that I want to say here is perhaps the best test of all is selfishness. Why are we eating? Just as a sheer enjoyment for ourselves, or is it because we are sharing that food with others? And here's something that the psychologists would say, that gluttony is often an indication of a spiritual or a psychological lack of security. That's one of the things that psychiatrists ask, if to find the way if a person is insecure, whether they are overeating or not. And when I look at people that are overeating, I can see that as one of the reasons why that happens. Secondly, luxurious living is often a picture of the spiritual life. Three headings you've got there in your notes. The picture of a banquet is at the heart of the Christian gospel, Matthew 22, 1-14. Luke 15 and the story of the prodigal son. When the prodigal son returned, he was given that marvelous banquet, and the elder son, if you remember, says, "Well, look, Dad, what are you doing here? This chap's been sleeping around, spending all the family money," and he returns home. "What do? You give him a banquet." And the father has to say to the elder son, "Well, all that I have is thine, and I am always with you." The picture of a banquet is at the heart of the Christian gospel. That's what we are inviting people to enjoy. A banquet, not just in spiritual things, a banquet in physical, mental, and social things. The heart of the Christian gospel is the picture of a banquet. The picture of a feast is at the heart of Christian worship. Picture your own family at home, you're entertaining. What is happening? You're enjoying the occasion, and you are enjoying a relationship with your friends. I hope that your dinner parties are happy occasions, and I hope that when they're over, even though when you said goodbye to your friends at 1 o'clock or whatever it is in the morning, you've still got to go and do the dishes. But I hope that you've enjoyed the evening, and your friends have enjoyed the evening. Now, isn't it a tragedy that when people come into Christian worship, that they don't experience either of these two things? One, it's not an enjoyable thing to them, and there is no sense of friendship or fellowship. And I believe that that means that we have to amend our ideas of Christian worship and make them much more biblical. The picture of the banquet is at the heart of the Christian gospel. The picture of a feast is at the heart of Christian worship. The picture of a meal is at the heart of Christian growth. We know how much food a man needs to sustain life. We look at tragic pictures of people starving in Pakistan or Biafra or wherever it is, and we say, what a tragedy. All they need is some food. Well, I look at Christian people sometimes, and I see them looking just like that. They're desperately thin. They are starving in a spiritual sense. And the reason, of course, is they're not getting enough spiritual food, both daily in their own Bible reading and on Sundays in their own worship. My tummy gurgles, or whatever the word is, when I don't have food. I haven't been gluttonous, but between the two services, I've had my lunch, so it's not rumbling this time. The unfortunate thing is spiritually, people's spiritual tummies don't rumble when they're not getting enough food. I wish they did. It may cause them to be looking for spiritual food. Let me say one or two things about fasting in conclusion, because I think it's a very important subject that we've rejected in our own time. First of all, it is a biblical experience. God commanded in the Old Testament one day of fasting, the Day of Atonement. After the people's return from Babylon, 4 days of fasting were instituted. In New Testament times, fasting frequently was used by godly people. While Jesus deliberately refused to accept fasting undertaken with false motives, he commanded the disciples to fast. He said, when you fast, in the Sermon on the Mount, and often I hear people taking that text, when you pray, as a command that we do pray. Well, there's a similar command there to fast. When you fast. Fasting is a biblical experience. If you happen to be an Anglican, fasting is an Anglican experience. Sometime open page 55 of your Book of Common Prayer, and you will find that there are 118 listed days of fasting and abstinence for all Anglicans. I wouldn't ask you to put up your hand if you're an Anglican, and to tell me how often you have fasted in this past year. I can't honestly say that I've fasted 18 days, let alone 118. I certainly used to fast when I began my ministry, but since I've had children I haven't fasted. I used to spend that extra time in prayer, but now I think it's probably more important that I'm at my meal table as regularly as I can be, because obviously a meal table is at the very center of family life. Fasting is a biblical experience. It is an Anglican experience. It is a spiritual experience. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus divides the Christian life into three main groups. There is our behavior towards others. That is in the terms of almsgiving. There is our behavior towards God. That is in the terms of prayer. There is the behavior towards ourselves, that is in the terms of discipline. And we discipline ourselves by fasting. I think we've overreacted against the mechanical fasting of the Middle Ages, and we've turned far too far away, and so it's not found at all in the church today. Let me just remind you that some of the great preachers of the past, ministers, have fasted regularly. Charles Spurgeon of the last century fasted, and spoke on fasting, and he said that the Christian church had lost a blessing when it gave up fasting. Martin Luther fasted. John Calvin fasted. Augustine fasted. John Wesley fasted. The early Methodists followed the practice of the early church by fasting twice a week. The Puritans wrote a book on fasting, a Puritan, and he called it the soul-fattening institution of fasting. Well, any Puritans could call a book with a title like that, I think. Someone came up to me after the first service and said, well, of course, that was typical of the Puritans. Now, I dread remarks like that, because historically they are absolutely untrue. Someone said to me on a television program not long ago, but that's the Puritan attitude. And I think I want to just spend the last couple of minutes saying something about the Puritans. When we use the word Puritans, or the group of people in the 17th century, that word was not used about their life, the lives of these men. We say, of course, he was a Puritan. He didn't do this on a Sunday. I think you'd be shattered if you discovered what the Puritans in the 17th century did on Sundays, from their games of bowls onwards. I think you'd be shocked by some of the way that they lived at all times. They didn't restrict their life. They had a very biblical view of life. Ice cream wasn't invented then, but I'm quite sure they would have said, thank God for ice cream. They had, in one sense, a very materialistic view of life. The reason why they were called Puritans was because they sought to be pure insofar as church government and church doctrine is concerned.